Hello, and welcome to the So You Want to Be a Marine Biologist podcast, where we learn about the ocean, share sea stories, and explore ocean careers. I'm your host, Kara Muzia. Let's dive into today's episode. This episode is brought to you by you. Thank you to those of you who have become patrons of the So You Want to Be a Marine Biologist podcast. For less than the cost of a dive tank refill or a cup of coffee, you can help keep the podcast episodes coming. There's also some fun bonuses for patrons, so be sure to check those out at patreon.com/marinebiolife. That's patreon.com/marinebiolife. Happy Earth Day! Today celebrates the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, and I'm excited to share today's episode with you. But first, why does it take pirates so long to learn the alphabet? Because they spend years at sea. Today's guest is Patrick Rinn, ocean engineer, marine physicist, and founder and CEO of Waterlust, an advocate apparel brand that is making waves for our ocean. After earning his undergrad degree in material engineering, Patrick found that he wanted to know more about the jobs that use the materials rather than manufacturing the materials themselves. This led him to a pivotal summer at the world-renowned Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. This summer sparked Patrick's love for two things in the ocean, kite surfing and underwater vehicles. He pursued both and found himself getting his master's degree in ocean engineering. Patrick shares the interesting dilemma he faced when choosing whether or not to pursue his PhD, and ultimately where he chose to go. Patrick also dives into how he combined his love for science as well as his creative side in order to create the brainchild that is Waterlust. In this episode, we learn one of Patrick's favorite lessons, the triangle of life. It's something that has personally stuck with me for many years. We also hear some of the amazing stories behind creating the films that are a major part of Waterlust, and how combining art and science has made a fulfilling career for this ocean physicist and entrepreneur. Please enjoy. Pat, welcome to the So You Want to Be a Marine Biologist podcast. I am so excited to chat with you.
Hey, Kara. Thanks for having me.
So you are the first engineer that I've had on the podcast, which is really fun. What inspired a career in engineering and then ultimately ocean science?
That's a good question. I think I liked engineering as a kid, or I was attracted to it as a kid because I liked to build stuff. And so I decided to study that in undergrad. And I actually studied material engineering, mostly just because I was curious about what things were made out of. But then when I graduated and I actually saw what career path that was likely going to lead to, I got a little spooked and kind of decided to pivot. And I thought about what was the subject that I loved the most. And growing up as a sailor and a surfer and being out by the ocean my whole life, that was my heart really was, in the ocean. So I decided to try to get into ocean engineering, which was sort of a bit of a niche discipline. That it was a little challenging, but I was able to do it. And I got a master's in ocean engineering, focusing on like robotics, building different robots that you would use to collect oceanographic data. And it was through that experience that I became a little like, I don't want to say envious of the scientists, but as an engineer, you spend a lot of time building something. And then when you finally like get it to work, you sort of hand it off to the end user. And in that case, it was the physical oceanographers and scientists and stuff. And I felt like I didn't understand what the end users needed the robots for, like what were the fundamental questions that they were trying to answer. And that frustrated me a lot because I felt like as an engineer, I could do a better job if I understood the science that I was working to help address. So when it came time, I decided to do a PhD. I decided to kind of pivot again and move into what's called applied marine physics. And my hope was that I'd come out of that degree with sort of like an appreciation for engineering and appreciation for science and be able to kind of like bridge the gap between the two.
Amazing. So you've covered a lot in a short amount of time. I want to go back and break down what exactly is an ocean engineer, and what did you do at FAU? I mean, you got your master's there, but you had a really cool autonomous project. Would you break that down a little bit more?
Yeah. So, I mean, ocean engineering is a kind of a broad term that describes a whole bunch of engineering activities that happen in the marine environment. So it could range from underwater acoustics and communication using acoustics to the building of structures that, you know, live underwater or at the, you know, air-sea interface. Or what I did was work on robotics. And my master's project was on developing it's called autonomous, which is, it's basically like developing a robot that kind of thinks for itself. and we tried to build basically like a robotic sailboat that would get propelled around the ocean using the wind and solar energy and take measurements of both the air and the water. And the idea was this was, you know, you could put a robot out and it could cover a much broader swath of the ocean for less cost. And it's been fun. I think it was a pretty novel idea at the time. But since then, a lot of companies and efforts have emerged, and it really has become a pretty big part of physical oceanography. So it's cool to see that work, I guess, was leading to something.
Yeah, that's really neat. It's crazy to think about that. Not only are there remotely operated vehicles, I mean, even sailboats out there, but you could actually program it, put it in the water, and it thinks for itself, and it'll go out and collect data for you. Incredible.
Yeah. And there's lots of different ones now. We were working on what we call surface vehicles, which are like boats because they sit on the surface. And then there's underwater vehicles that are look like little torpedoes, little submarines. And then they also have aerial vehicles. I mean, there's a whole bunch of autonomous technology. You know, and the ocean's a very, very big place, and it's quite expensive to take a research vessel and bring it to a certain part of the ocean to get data. So if you can use, you know, a small little robot to do it, you save costs, and you also it's also safer, especially if you're going to a dangerous place where maybe you don't want people to go.
Right. So you send a robot. Before you were at FAU, you were a guest investigator at Woods Hole. What did that mean, and what did you get to do there?
Yeah, that was a funny story. and there's, a lesson there that I try to share with students when they're aspiring to get into, you know, ocean science and engineering. When I came out of undergrad, I had zero experience in anything related to the ocean in terms of ocean engineering subjects. So when I sent my resume out to different labs and different places, I generally was ignored because I just didn't have anything that suggested that I would be a useful fit. And that was really frustrating. I also applied right out of undergrad. I applied to grad school to a variety of different grad schools, and I got rejected. And they said, you don't have any experience. And I was like, no, I'm trying to get experience. And that's sort of a conundrum I think a lot of students find themselves in. But I kind of just hung in there, and I just kept writing to different researchers at different labs. And I lived very close. I grew up about 45 minutes from Woods Hole, which is a world famous oceanographic institute. And I kept writing these different scientists, and I wasn't getting any responses, not even getting a response. In all fairness, these professors, they get dozens of these emails a day. So I'm not, you know, trying to criticize them. I understand why they didn't. So I was sort of frustrated. And then finally, it was a friend of a friend of, and his wife, told her that I was looking to try to get my foot in the door. And she said that she knew someone at Woods Hole, and to just shoot him an email and basically drop a name and say hey, I'm friends with so-and-so, which was a person that I had never met. And I was like, okay. And so I, and this was a researcher who I had written before, and hadn't got a response back from. And so I sent him an email and I dropped the name, and he wrote back and was like, oh, okay. Well, if you're friends with this person, like, that sounds good. Why don't you come in and let's chat? And I was like, oh man, that worked. And, so I went to Hui and I met with him, and the first thing, so I walk in the door and the first thing he asked was, how do you know so-and-so? So like, how do you know him? And I said, I actually don't know him. And I told him the story. I was very candid with him. I said, you know, this is my friend and da-da-da-da-da, and I've emailed you before. And like, I really want to get experience, and I'll sweep the floors. I'll take out the trash. You don't have to pay me. Like I you know, I'm just here. I'm thirsty. I'm hungry for this. And I think he was sort of like entertained by it. And he also was he really liked sailing. And at the time, mm-hmm. I was on the Olympic sailing team, mm-hmm. which is a whole other track of my life. And he was like very entertained by that. And he said, okay, you know, you can come and do a summer kind of internship in my lab. It was the Deep Submergence Laboratory at Woods Hole. And he was building these really cool deep water submersibles that were going 4,000 or 5,000 meters deep, deepest parts of the ocean. And, you know, he gave me a little project and, you know, I went there every day. And that was my opening into the ocean science world. And I used that to, you know, create another opportunity and another one and another one. And it's funny, he's now one of like my good friends. He was a professor at Woods Hole, and I believe he's a professor at Northeastern or BU. And he's a great guy, and he's been kind of one of my mentors for my whole career, which is funny how it all worked out.
That is really very serendipitous how that all worked out.
And yeah, and he also, another very important thing is it was sort of part of the agreement is if I was going to work at his lab, he wanted me to learn how to kiteboard. And he thought I had never done that before. And he's like, you need to get into kite surfing, because he was an avid kite surfer. And I was like, well, that seems like a pretty fair trade-off. So he actually gave me a trainer kite, a little kite that I flew when I, you know, and had off time that summer. And ultimately I ended up getting really, really into kite surfing, and it's probably my favorite activity to do now. And I look back and I'm like, well, man, that was just like such a serendipitous meeting with this person. And it all kind of came about from that attitude of just kind of hang in there, keep pushing, you know, push through defeat. And you know, I do truly believe in life, if you want to do something and you're not willing to say no, if you just keep hanging in there, you will eventually get there. You just have to be really persistent. And, you know, for me, for my, you know, going to grad school and going to the PhD, I had applied to grad schools for 3 years in a row and I got rejected every year. But then my fourth year, I got in and I got a fellowship to pay for it. So it's one of those things, you just kind of keep going, keep pushing, and you'll get there.
Absolutely. It's a really good lesson. What a pivotal summer for you.
Huge, huge, huge summer.
I want to come back to the Olympic sailing.
Yeah, sorry, to sort of like drop that in there.
And I had forgotten that you were on the Olympic team. I knew that you did a lot of sailing in your undergrad, and that's how we met, is sailing. And so how did the Olympic sailing thing come about and then fit into this ocean science realm?
I mean, it didn't really fit. They were kind of at odds with one another. When I graduated undergrad, I had sailed in college and had success with that. And I really loved the sport, and I was still kind of thirsty to take it farther and see where I could go with it. And it had always been sort of a childhood dream to sail at the Olympics. So I decided to get into a new class of boat. It's called the 49er. It was relatively new then. That was like, this is probably like 2002, 2003. And when I graduated, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. Like I had done this material engineering stuff, but I knew I didn't want to do that. I knew I loved the ocean, but I didn't know how to equate that. And I was getting turned down by, like I said before, all of these, you know, research labs I was trying to get involved with. So it seemed kind of like a reasonable decision to just like start sailing competitively and professionally. And that's mm-hmm. what prompted me to move from Massachusetts to Florida. And Miami has the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Coconut Grove in Miami, where you can sail pretty much year round. And so I moved down with my teammate, who is a guy named Frank Eustache, who I grew up with. He's a great guy. And we just kind of decided to throw all of our stuff in the car. And we had a really beat up boat. And we moved down to Florida and just started trying to pursue the dream. And we were terrible at first. We never really got, honestly, we never really got that good. But we made the team. I think in our last year, we made the U.S. Olympic team. And we competed in the Olympic trials. We did not qualify for, at the time, that was the Beijing Olympics. But our plan was, when you do Olympic stuff, you usually do multiple what they call quadrenniums, like quads, every four-year cycle. So we got into the boat in like 2000, really got into the boat seriously in 2005, 2006, and the Olympic trials were in 2008. So we didn't expect that we were gonna win the trials competing against teams that had been sailing the boat. You know, they were on their second quad. So our goal was really looking at 2012, which was the Olympic Games. And so we were looking at that first trials in 2008 as sort of a learning experience and something that we would use to kind of mature our game. I found out while I was campaigning that I was getting mentally fairly restless. And so, and my mentor from Woods Hole kind of suggested to me, you should get a master's degree while you're doing this. And that's what brought me to FAU, where we met. And so I decided to campaign and race and also balance that with grad school, which was a bit tricky, but doable. And then at the 2008 trials, after the trials were done, I had to kind of make a decision about whether I wanted to do another 4 years or whether I wanted to invest, you know, in my education and kind of pursue my career as a scientist and an engineer. It didn't seem like I could really do both well at the same time. Mm-hmm. A PhD program is a lot more rigorous than a master's program. I could do it in the master's, but I couldn't swing it with the PhD. And mm-hmm. so ultimately I had to make a really hard decision and decided to kind of step away from the sailing and start a PhD program instead. But it was one of the smartest decisions I think I've ever made. So I'm happy I did.
It's always nice when you make a decision and you look back and you're like, no, that was the right call for sure.
Yeah.
I think you were the one that told me about your theory of the social triangle, and it was, or the triangle of being able to be good at something. And it was, you have at each point of the triangle, you have social life, your sport, or your academics. Mm-hmm. And you can only be good at two of them. And if you try to do all three, you will either fail at something or just be like barely making it by. There's no way to excel at all three at the same time. You have to pick two.
Yes, I give that advice often to
Okay, so it was you. Yep. I'm like, I'm pretty sure that was that.
Yep.
And I think that's great advice. And it's really true.
Yeah. I mean, I think I learned that. So I do a lot of coaching, and a backstory of how we met. And I think I was doing some coaching for FAU while I was doing my master's. And I met you and a yes. variety of other FAU students. Yes. And one thing I learned in my undergrad is exactly what you said, is that, you know, there's sort of those three things. And the key point is that you can do two out of the three of them exceptionally well. Like you can do all three of them mediocrely well. But you know, if you want to get straight A's in school and you want to, you know, be the life of the social scene, or you want to be like an all-American athlete, in college, it's very difficult to do all three of those. You know, you can be the all-American athlete and get straight A's, but you're probably not going to have much of a social life, you know, or there's always that sort of trade-off. And I think that that's it's important for students to kind of keep that in mind and be conscious of making those decisions and prioritizing what's important to them. So yeah, it's fun. I'm glad to hear that you remembered it, because sometimes I like say these things, but I don't know if it just goes in people's ears and out the other.
No, you said it. And I was like, that makes sense. And it's something that has stuck with me throughout the rest of my undergrad and even like a little bit into life. I'm like, what three things am I trying to be really good at and not? And it's an interesting concept, but it's really true. You gotta kind of pick two that you really want to be exceptional
at. Yeah, I think it applies. I think about it now, like in my professional life, you know, I think a lot about, and we think a lot at Waterlust about life balance and trying to have a, you know, if any time life gets out of balance, things can go wonky. And I think the same thing applies, whether it's, you know, balancing your professional career with your family, with your activities, you know, things that just kind of make you happy. And those are sort of maybe the three things post-college. But I think it's one of these things that never goes away. It's, you're constantly trying to like find balance in these, how you prioritize things.
Yes. The triangle. Do you have a name for it?
No, I think there's a similar thing in engineering where they talk about if there's like a triangle of getting products, and you can have a product be made really well, get done really cheap, and get to you really quickly. And you can only have two out of the three of those. And I think maybe that's subconsciously, I thought of that and how it applies to this, but I think that thing has a name within the engineering field. So maybe we just call it that.
Well, we might have to find that name, the life triangle.
Yeah.
So you decide to go back and get your PhD and you apply to University of Miami. Now, did you want to go specifically to UM, or did you want to live in Miami because that's where you were sailing and that seemed like a great place to be?
That was actually probably one of the most difficult decisions I've had to make in my life. I wasn't actually, UM really wasn't originally on my radar when I was applying for PhD programs. My original plan was to go back to Boston and go to Woods Hole. And that was, you know, they have a great program there. It was close to my family and everything. And there were other schools around the country that I was really interested in. And UM really kind of wasn't on my radar. And I think I'd sort of taken it for granted just because I had been going to school right up the road and for whatever reason. And I remember one of my professors just sort of in passing kind of checked in and was like, okay, well, where are you applying? And I told him, and he asked, well, why aren't you looking at University of Miami and the Rosenstiel School, which is their, it's sort of like their satellite campus, sort of like if you have a business school or a medical school, they have a ocean science school and it's called the Rosenstiel School. And, he's like, you've got to check them out. It's a really great place to go do a PhD. And I said, okay, I didn't know. But the deadline had passed for my application. So I sent them an email and I said, hey, it was like 2 weeks past or something. And I was like, hey, I'm up the road and I'm really sorry. And deadline's passed. And but if you're willing to take even look at my application, like I'd love to kind of come check it out. And they were very, very nice about it. And they said, yeah, sure. Send your application and you're past the deadline, but it's cool. Like we'll take a look. And they invited me down, to check out the campus. And I was just, I don't know. I was really blown away by the people. And it was, it had a vibe. What's really interesting about Rasmus is there's these incredibly smart people that work there, but the vibe of the community is pretty darn laid back and people don't really take themselves too seriously. And so they had this whole like student meet and greet, and they have an amazing student run bar called the Wet Lab. that is overlooking Key Biscayne, Biscayne Bay. And so we were like, I was like drinking a beer and like looking, chatting with current students. And then I was chatting with some guy about Ekman currents in the ocean or something. And then, and he was like, just like super down to earth dude who just, I just figured, I didn't even know he worked there. And then I found out later that he like wrote the, like a textbook that I used. And I was like, man, this is like, this is pretty special. So when it came down to making the decision, I had to decide between going up, back up, up north. I'd gotten into to Woods Hole, which was what a big goal of mine. And my family was all kind of anticipating that I was going to go there. And I had gotten into some other schools as well. But ultimately, I decided to go to UM because I felt like that that community had something very special in the way they had balance. You know, I talk about balance a lot. It was, you know, the weather was beautiful. I could have, I could really like immerse myself in nature. I was a little scared about going back up to New England and having these cold, dark winters. And then the people were incredibly friendly and approachable, and they were doing amazing, you know, cutting edge work. And something about it, I just kind of spoke to me and said, like, this is the place you're supposed to go. And it really, like, it was tough in my family. Like, they were, everyone was pretty surprised. I didn't go back home. And, but ultimately that decision, put me in a position where I got to have this amazing education that included a lot of flexibility and encouragement to be creative and to think outside of the typical academic, tracks. And that is how Waterlust was created. You know, it started in my second year, of my PhD at UM. And I really got a lot of support and nurturing from my academic advisors, the faculty, the staff, the administration, other students. Everyone was incredibly supportive of these like weird ideas that I had. and so, I mean, the school really means a lot to me because none of this would happen if I hadn't have had that.
UM is all over Waterlust. It's really cool to see kind of kicking back to your roots. And it's fun to see how Waterlust has evolved from, I mean, when you started it, I actually rewatched the first ever Waterlust video the other night. And it's fun to see that it went from, and it still is about enjoying the water and just being out in the water and nature and appreciating it, and to more of a science aspect of it as well. It's still about appreciating what nature is and what the ocean has to offer, but there's definitely more of a sciencey and thoughtful spin to it, which is really fun.
Yeah, that it's
to see that evolution.
That's evolved sort of over time, and it was, we were strategic with it, and it was always our intention to get more and more sciencey, but we realized like at the beginning we want to kind of grab people's attention, and sometimes that can be hard to do just with, you know, pure science topics. And it's also, you know, you can go make a fun video of diving or kite surfing or something. It's pretty easy to do as a grad student, but it might be a lot more difficult to fly halfway around the world to a lab, and that's a much more complicated process. So we started with kind of low-hanging fruit and have evolved to more complex projects.
And I want to dive a little bit more into it, but what, your PhD is in applied marine physics. What was your thesis?
my thesis, I looked at these things called tidal inlets. And so a tidal inlet is basically like a harbor entrance. It's like a narrow, what they describe as a narrow conduit, which is like a fancy word for just saying like an opening. Between a bay or a lagoon or an estuary and the ocean. So if you've ever been to like a harbor, pretty much every harbor is either like an estuary or a lagoon. And when you take your boat out and you go out to the ocean, you go through this sort of like narrow opening. And that narrow opening is the tidal inlet. And what I was looking at is every time the tide goes up and down, water gets flushed into the harbor or the lagoon, and then it gets flushed back out. And that's a really interesting dynamic process. And one thing that people are very interested in, because so many people live by the water now, and there's a lot of pollutants and contaminants and things that can get kind of accumulated into these lagoons and harbors. We wanted to look at how that water is transported out into the ocean, and how it is replaced by kind of new seawater that gets in. And there's this process called tidal exchange, where it's almost sort of like breathing. When the tide comes out, it's almost like you're exhaling. You exhale a breath, you know, carbon dioxide. And then when you inhale, you're pulling in oxygen. If you can imagine, if you breathed out and then you just were able to breathe in the air you had just breathed out, we wouldn't survive very long. We would, you know, it would be like putting a bag over your mouth and just breathing out carbon dioxide and then just breathing in the carbon dioxide that you just exhaled. The same thing sort of mm-hmm. happens in the lagoon when water gets pulled out into the ocean during an outgoing tide. On the next incoming tide, because of the dynamics of the currents, it actually pulls in a lot of new water. So you get this transport of stuff from that was in the harbor out to the ocean, and then you get stuff that's in the ocean pulled into the harbor. And this is really important. It's a really important process for maintaining good water quality in inland waters. And if you have an inlet that, you know, isn't doing its job as well as it could, you could have poor water quality issues. So that was my research was on doing a lot of computer modeling of that and trying to sort of understand what controls that process.
There's a waterless video with it. When you put dye in the water and got to watch it swirl around, that was fascinating to watch.
Yeah, there's a few that are similar. One of them is not totally related to my research. So you might be thinking about there's one on the beach where we put a lot of dye in the water. There's one, I don't know if we did like a big video on my research, but there's definitely at least a couple of Instagram videos or whatnot. It's always fun to like, mm-hmm. yeah, to do some stuff that's closer to our own research. Though, you know, physical oceanography and marine physics doesn't tend to be as sexy as a subject as a lot of marine biology or stuff like that. But I'm always really excited to slip it in whenever I get the chance.
Absolutely. Actually, we rewatched. Nick was like, oh, I've totally seen this before. The ocean blocking or the wave blocking video the other night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was a fun, that was just a random, we didn't even intend. We kind of like inadvertently filmed this time lapse in British Columbia that showed this really weird physical process. And it wasn't for years later. I would like stumble upon the clip and be like, what is going on there? And then finally I'm like, I need to like dive into this. And we made just a little video like explaining the dynamics, and it was cool. It started a whole conversation amongst different folks online. It was really fun.
That is really cool. And just a quick synopsis of the video. It's a time lapse, and you get to learn what happens when the current overpowers the oncoming wind. And it's not what you expect.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's not. It's I've never seen anything like that in the world. And it's a fact. It's caused because the tidal currents in that part of the world can get up to 10 to, I think the maximum is 13 knots, which is like unheard of. It's like a raging river. And the currents become so small that, or so the currents become so strong that waves, it's like running on a treadmill and the waves just can't keep up and they just get flushed out.
It's fascinating. I've loved a lot of your videos. I mean, we watched the whole series with the building the camper and then building the sailboat up in Annapolis and sailing that all the way back down the coast. And then we watched the marine microfiber, or just the microfiber one the other night for the first time. That was really interesting.
I'm glad. Thank you.
What is your favorite? Yeah. What has been one of your favorite waterless videos to make, or a couple of them? I'm sure there's a lot that you love.
I think that's a good question. I think what I like, what I'm most proud of, and the ones that mean the most to me, are when we can make a video that is bringing to life someone's work. So I think, like, you know, most recently we did a film about sockeye salmon in Alaska that we put out around Christmas this year. And what's really fun is when you get to go meet a scientist or a researcher that's, you know, been doing this work for their whole career, and they're doing amazing stuff. And to be able to, I mean, oftentimes it's difficult for people to just kind of come home and be like, you know, how was your day at work? And you're like, oh, you know, it's pipetting DNA. And, you know, it's like, it's kind of hard, I think, for scientists to make their stuff really, relatable and understandable, by general public.
At least the day-to-day.
Yeah. The day-to-day minutia. Yeah. Like, you know, everyone has like their elevator speech of like kind of what they do. Mm-hmm. But to be able to not just tell the story, but to capture like the essence of the feeling of what that work is all about. Like when they are out in the field and spending days on end, and if you can make something where they're like, yes, that video feels like what I feel. That's a really special thing that we're really proud of, because it's like we get to kind of like capture a feeling for the scientists that they might not otherwise be able to express to the world. I mean, over the years, we made a lot of different adventure videos and different things like that. And a lot of that is just to kind of cut our teeth in video production and to like learn how to do it and just have learn more and more lessons and how to make a good video. But really our focus now is, now that we've sort of figured that out, is to take all those lessons and apply them to telling meaningful and important stories. And that's sort of, I would say probably the salmon video is the one I'm most proud of at this point. And we're hoping to do essentially that same thing for all of the cause tracks that we support through our Advocate Apparel program.
That was a really incredible video. Definitely recommend going to watch it. We kind of jumped in a little bit towards the end, but how did, you know, you mentioned you're in undergrad, you decided to start making videos and Waterlust. How did that come about? Was it just like you woke up in the morning and you're like, oh, I think it'd be really cool to make videos about the water, and you know, there's so many like-minded people that love the ocean. How did it start?
It mostly started as just a kind of like a indescribable itch. So it was my, I was in my second year of the PhD program, and I just was starting to feel a little restless in terms of my creative side of my brain. Science has a lot of creativity to it, but it also has a lot of rules and structures and things that you have to, you know, boundaries that you need to stay within. You know, the scientific method, you can't just go rogue. You have to kind of, you know, you have to follow certain rules. And I don't really like rules. And that, I think, it was tough for me day after day after day. I felt very constrained, and I just felt this really strong desire to do some type of side project, like just something that where I could just be, I could be creative and do something however I wanted to do it. And that's really where the itch came from. And I had a few ideas that I was trying to like develop. And, at the time I was experimenting and learning how to make videos, and I was coaching sailing and making some little goofy videos to help sailors kind of learn some stuff. And the video, you know, camera technology was such that it was becoming more and more approachable, and computers and editing software were becoming a lot easier to use. And it all kind of like came together where I thought, okay, like making, you know, little videos is the most approachable project for me to do as in, you know, on the side of my PhD research. And so I decided to just kind of start with that. And I decided to name it something because I didn't want it to be like Patrick Rin's videos. You know, I thought that was, I didn't want it to be about me. I wanted it to be about, like, I wanted people to just stay focused on like what the subject is about. And, you know, I ran, that was the beginning, and I ran the idea past my advisor, and he was a really, really interesting Dutch guy. And he was like, yeah, sure. You know, whatever. He was just very liberal with things. And I had to actually like skip a final exam and fly to Australia. There was a field experiment that I kind of invited myself to. I said, hey, if I can get myself there and I bring some cameras, can I like make a little YouTube video about your research? And it was about rip currents. And there were some really important conclusions that were coming out of their research. And I had helped their team in the previous summer, just sort of helping out in the research. And they said, yeah, you get yourself here, you can come. And I had a big project due at Rasmus. And I asked if I could get like a extension because I wanted to go down and make this YouTube video. And he said, sure. I mean, this is Rasmus. This is that supportive community. And he said, sure. And so I went down. I've actually written a blog about this very story on the Waterless blog, but for people if they want to check out more. But the
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah. So they let me go down, and I just showed up. I had no idea what I was doing. I had a bunch of GoPros, and that's about it. And I shot all this stuff, and we made the, and that was really the first real waterless video was this one called Rip, and it was about rip currents and safety and nearshore dynamics. And we put it out. I put it on. We my sister and I came up with the name Waterless, and I put it on the internet, and everybody liked it, and that was sort of the beginning. That's how it all started.
And it's a beautiful thing, and it's grown since.
It has. Yeah, it has grown a lot.
And it's evolved quite a bit. So you've gone from making these wonderful videos, and you continue to do so, to creating apparel. What was that evolution like?
So first, when we gave it a name, and I say we, my now wife entered the picture pretty much at the very beginning. She was there for the inception of the idea, and then she really became very involved with it not too long after. But yeah, we gave it a name, and we were making these videos, and people were enjoying them. And at some point, we were like, oh, we should like make some t-shirts like for fun, for the fans, you know, for people to like this. And so we started like screen printing t-shirts in our kitchen. And eventually, like Fiona, my wife, she came up with our logo, which is this water droplet with a fingerprint. And so then we put those in the t-shirts, and people really liked them. And we were just like, oh, this is cool. But it wasn't it as my PhD, and she was doing her master's at the time, as that kind of like progressed on, you start having, and you know, you've been in school, you have the same probably experience, as you get towards the end of your degree, that little voice in the back of your head starts creeping up, and it's like, what are you going to do when you graduate? Like, where is this going? What is the plan? You have to be an adult now. Now what? And so we really loved the work we were doing at Waterlust. It felt like it was hitting upon all of our interests in a unique way. And we just were like, we need to figure out a way to do this as a career. And we had sort of two routes. One was like to stick with media production and try to earn, you know, somehow survive off of that, maybe being a nonprofit, getting people to donate or however that way. And then we had this idea of kind of turning it into a cause-driven apparel brand. And my sister-in-law, she's a really talented seamstress, and she was working in New York City. And I knew that she, you know, I'd gotten wind that she kind of was looking for a change in her life or career. New York City wasn't really doing it for her anymore. And so we kind of, my wife and I, we weren't married at the time, we were just dating, but we were like, maybe we can get Laura, her name's Laura, to come down and like kind of take, if we just kind of like hand this off to her and see if she can like make something of it. And I honestly didn't think that she would, because it's kind of like a pretty risky proposition. But she's pretty bold, and she decided to move to Miami. And that was like in 2014. And so she came in, and we just, you know, we hadn't done really much at all. We had done some shirts and some basic stuff. But we were like, why don't you just kind of like, just kind of experiment with whatever you think would be cool. And somewhere along the lines, we, as we were all brainstorming, we had this idea of putting, like making the clothing like a conversation piece for a conservation topic. And then that way we could tie the products into the science, so that when every time someone's wearing something, they can kind of represent the research, and they can help become sort of like a lightning rod to communicate the findings of the work. And we really loved that idea. And Laura did an amazing job kind of knocking out some original concepts. And we just, you know, we did started with really small batches, and she had to find, you know, we knew if we wanted to make clothing, it would be hugely hypocritical if we weren't using the most environmentally responsible materials and methods, manufacturing methods possible. So she, and that's her background, was in that kind of sustainability of the apparel industry. So she, she went out and found some amazing materials and formed some really great early partnerships. And then we, I think our first really popular products were our women's leggings. And she just kind of like made them, like she's like, I would totally use these. I need a pair. So she just like made a pair. And then started experimenting with photography that we had from our media work, and putting the prints on the leggings. And then we just kind of put one up on Facebook, and we had already kind of had an audience of people from our video work, and people really seemed to like them. So we're like, okay, we'll just sell them. And they became pretty popular. And Laura, bless her heart, she sewed, I think, the first 600 pairs or so that we sold.
Oh my gosh.
So she was just, those early days, she was just like sewing constantly. And that was like the beginning. That kind of was like the validation of the concept of Advocate Apparel, which is the name we gave it. And since then, we've really pursued that more and developed it more. And now it's really the focal point of our business, where we support all these different science tracks through different clothing designs. And we donate a portion of the sales to back to the research labs. And we do make videos and do all these social media work to help communicate the science to the world. And that's been really fun. And it was sort of unexpected. I never thought, none of us thought we would be, you know, an apparel company, but we still identify ourselves as a science communication company. And we just use clothing as just a tool. And we're open to whatever tools come our way.
I love that you guys felt the need to be environmentally responsible and recognized that it wouldn't have felt right if you were making these leggings out of, you know, virgin materials versus you, I know you guys use recycled materials and you're very aware of manufacturing processes. And that's one of the reasons why I love the apparel and the idea behind it. So that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's been a fun, it's funny that, you know, anything you do comes with an environmental cost. And we try to be very transparent and candid with our customers about that. And we think it's really important for people to be mindful about the impact that their daily life decisions, including what they buy, has on the planet. So it's funny that as we've gotten more and more into the environmental impact of clothing, I've actually kind of gone back to my undergrad roots, which was on material engineering of polymers and non-metallic materials. So it's just been a total blast to be like tapping back into that education I had. I didn't think I was going to use that again, but lo and behold,
came full circle.
Yeah, come full circle. You never know.
Truly, you never know. That is valuable, though. I could absolutely see how that education would be valuable in an industry where you do make materials.
Yeah, I think one thing I've been disheartened by is, you know, the apparel industry is pretty unregulated. People can do kind of whatever they want. It's not like if you're making food or something that people consume, there are checks and balances you must follow in order to get approval to sell a product like that. But in the apparel industry, there really aren't these checks and balances, and companies and brands can really say whatever the heck they want. And and when we're sourcing, you know, materials, and we want to understand, you know, okay, where did this come from? How did you manufacture it? What are, like, show us the data about whether it's the carbon emissions or the water use or whatever it is. A lot of time manufacturers will, or companies will give you pretty haphazard analyses of things. Definitely things that would not pass muster in the academic community. So we kind of use our research background, and we consider peer review as the gold standard. You know, like, so if you say a material has, you know, say this biodegradation rate or something, it's not really enough for us for you to just tell us that, because I don't want to say we don't trust you, but like a business is biased. We really look for peer review publications that have been replicated by third parties. But this is a hard thing in the business world, because a lot of things are proprietary and people don't want to share exactly how stuff is made, because other people can steal ideas, and they do all the time. It's been really interesting. That's where I've kind of tapped back into my material engineering education, where we'll get information from a potential partner manufacturer, and then we'll bring it over to colleagues that we know in the material engineering and material science community and say, is this legit? You know, is this plot? Is this claim? Does this make sense? And we've had plenty of situations where it didn't make sense, and where there was a little bit of deception going on, and a little bit of, I don't want to say dishonesty, but just certainly not being totally forthright. So that process has been hugely impactful to how we run the business. And I think it's one thing that makes us pretty unique.
Absolutely. Waterlust is science communication and advocate apparel. And the idea is that the consumers would become advocates. What is one of the biggest kind of principles or guiding lights that you use when communicating science, or something that you try to convey to the people that buy your apparel?
That is a big question. I mean, there's a few things. I mean, for one, you have to keep things relatively simple. You can't get too, if you go too technical, too hard, you're going to turn away, you know, a portion of your audience right off the bat. So there's this balance between information and entertainment. And that is a give and take that we're always struggling with. Like, you could take a really stunning photo or have a really stunning video clip, but if it doesn't tell you anything, if it doesn't like teach you anything, then all it's done is entertained you as you've scrolled your social feeds or, you know, that kind of thing. But it, maybe it gets a lot of likes and clicks, and you know, you think, okay, this has been successful to some for some reason. Like, clicks and likes are good, if you might tell yourself. On the other hand, you might you go to the other extreme. You might do something that is extremely rich with information. You know, maybe like a written article or something, but it has no visuals. It doesn't pull you in. It doesn't like capture your imagination or invoke an emotional kind of feeling or something. And the same problem, like maybe it has the information, is there, but nobody reads it. And then you've still accomplished nothing. So we try to, there's this middle ground, there's a sweet spot where you have enough kind of aesthetic beauty and creativity and entertainment value so that people enjoy reading what you wrote or seeing your photos or watching your little videos. But there's also enough information where they walk away from it knowing something that they maybe didn't know before. And that's sort of where all with everything we do, whether it's our blogs or our emails or our, you know, our YouTube videos or even just Instagram posts or anything, is trying to find that balance where we're holding your attention, but we're also leaving you with something actionable and some knowledge that maybe you didn't have.
It's a good balance. It's, come back to the triangle again.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, that's there's no, I definitely don't have any like recipes for that. We're still trying to figure that one out.
Yes, it is a delicate balance. Well, we're kind of running up on the end of time here. A couple more questions. What you've been out in the field a lot, right? Both with your degrees and recording all of your videos. What is one of your favorite field stories or experiences to share? And this, like I said, could be something that you did filming Waterlust or amazing day that you had out in the field. Mm-hmm.
Favorite field experience. That's, I mean, what's, I don't want to be, the one that's most top of mind is the one we did most recently. So I think there's some bias there probably, but we got to go up with the University of Washington up to their field school in southwestern Alaska to do this work on sockeye salmon. That was pretty impactful. Seeing the work and the dedication, you know, I think what a lot of people don't maybe realize with science is that there are people that are dedicating every day of their lives and really doing some pretty grueling manual labor to get work done. And this goes on without the general public knowing. You know, it's just happening. It's happening right now. People are, and maybe not so much right now because of coronavirus, but so yeah, I mean, going up there and seeing there's this amazing team of undergrads and grad students and researchers and professors. And that's a program that has been going on since 1946. And it's this continuous data collection program that has just produced the most, a pretty stunning data set, really an unprecedented data set on a species, maybe anywhere in the world in terms of its longevity. And when you have a data set that's that long, you can start comparing it to large scale processes like climate change issues and stuff. So that trip was amazing. You know, we got to meet and see people in the indigenous community that live there, and it just seeing an unspoiled landscape, an unspoiled ecosystem, and you know, their message I think is very important. It's not, you know, the message from the UW researchers is not like, let's just don't touch nature. They're not like an all or nothing group. They're saying, you know, humans need to live in balance with nature. That's a theme we've talked a lot about today. And we just have to be mindful about how we're impacting nature, and we have to give nature a chance if we're careful with it and we monitor it and we make smart evidence-based decisions on how we treat it. And it's going to keep doing what we need it to do. And I think that the message of that is incredibly valuable and sometimes gets lost in the conservation conversation, where sometimes there are parties that say like, we have to just like abandon everything we're doing and humans are terrible. And they take this really kind of extreme perspective. I found that experience very, very, kind of moderate and reasonable, where it was like, you know, look, we can do this. We just have to be smart about it. And I walked away from, we spent like 10 days up in Alaska, and I walked away from that really, really affected by that message. And it's something I'll definitely carry with me forever.
Yeah, that's a great message to bring home, and an important, again, balance to strike. Which brings me beautifully to our conservation ask at the end of each episode. I like to give the audience something to take home that they can apply to their daily lives. What would be your conservation ask for the audience?
That's a good, you're full of very good questions that get me thinking a lot. We do have a sort of a similar thing. We think about like, what can we ask our customers to do to get them to be more engaged with all the different subjects. And I think arguably one of the most impactful things, not just from helping the environment, but just kind of getting yourself to look at things in a different way, is going out into nature and just kind of doing a little cleanup, you know. And that could be going to a beach with a, you know, a little bucket, and you just, anytime you see anything just that's trash, you just pick it up. It doesn't have to be the beach or the ocean. It can be, you can walk a river or a stream, or you can go walk, you know, go hike a hill or a mountain, or just go into your backyard and just walk around. And it's sort of like an Easter egg hunt, if you want, like looking, scavenger hunt, look for things that are there that shouldn't be there. And it has a twofold benefit. And one is you're helping the ecosystem by removing things that shouldn't be there and that can be harmful. But you're also, I think the bigger impact is what it has on you. And if you, at the end of your little adventure, if you look at everything you found and look at what it actually is and make the connection between what those things are and the decisions you make in your life. Because most of those things that you see are probably things that you use, bottle caps or plastic bags or straws or whatever. And I find that is if people are passionate about being a better advocate for the environment, that's a really, really good starting point. And it gets, you know, I don't know, it gets me thinking about decisions I make in a much different way. And it's a very, very easy thing.
You can do it from anywhere in the world. Where can the audience find you if they want to learn more about you or Waterlust?
We're pretty much everywhere on the social media thing. So, you know, we have a website, waterlust.com, where you can learn a lot about who we are. You can sign up for our newsletter, where we send out information if you're more of like an email person and you don't want to spend a lot of time on social media. But we're also on, you know, Facebook and Instagram, Twitter and YouTube and stuff. And so whatever, you know, the platform of your choice, if you want to interact with us. And
I'll put a link to all of that in the show notes as well.
Perfect. Yeah.
Well, Pat, this was so much fun. Thank you for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. It was a blast to reconnect and chat.
Hey, do you want to help the oceans? Have you considered a career in marine biology, but maybe just aren't sure where to start? Head on over to my website, marinebio.life, and subscribe to my newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll receive a free PDF download where you'll learn the 7 steps to becoming a marine biologist without the degree. Thank you for listening to today's show. I'd love to hear any insight you've gleaned. Leave a comment in the show notes or send me an email over at marinebio.life. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review and, of course, share with your friends. If you want more resources for ocean news, including conservation topics and careers, plus personal insight from me that I just don't share anywhere else, join me at marinebio.life and sign up for email updates. Keep after your dreams and making waves in your community. One person can make a difference. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you next time on the So You Want to Be a Marine Biologist podcast.